Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Thiers Latham, episode 253, Order of Battle for Isandlwana and Inyezani, as Ukhuni Wood heads north. Three separate British columns are inside Zululand and things are hotting up, and not just because of the steamy summer temperatures. In the last few episodes, I've concentrated on General Chelmsford and Colonel Glynn's operations in the centre, the second column, as they made their way over the Mzinyathi River across from Rorke's Drift, the centre of the British invasion of Zululand. This episode will wrap up what was going on in other sectors, further south near the coast, further north near the Ngqumi, Blood River, and along the high ground there towards the Pongola River. The first column under Colonel Charles Pearson had entered Zululand across the lower Tugela on the 12th of January and was lumbering towards Ishowe en route to meet up with Chelmsford's column 2 near Undini prior to the final assault on King Cetshwayo Kampani's headquarters. When the main Zulu army had set off from the ritual jumping-off point of Kwano Dwengu near Undini in the afternoon of Friday 17th of January 1879, destination Rorke's Drift, a smaller Zulu force marched off simultaneously. They went in the opposite direction, southwest, heading to intercept Colonel Pearson. The Mqapo Ubuta, who were young and motivated, along with the older men of the Uglambedlu and Izingulubi regiments, during the march south towards the Tugela, they would meet up with reinforcements. These were a lot of small local groups, the Insunkangeni, the Ikwa, Dududu, Inhlaba Kawombe, and a few other even smaller entities mustered along the coast. The total size of this force was around 6,000, led by 70-year-old Isikulu Godide, chief of the Ntuli and commander of the Uglambedlu regiment. He was also the elder brother of Mavuma Ngwenyana, who, as you know, was second in command of the main Zulu army marching towards Chelmsford. Alongside Godide were high-ranking coastal chiefs, Manchia Kai Mshandu of the Nzuzu, and the older Mbilwani Kai Mahlanganisu, who was also Induna of the Kwagingi Ndlovu Ikanda. Other important commanders who joined were Masekhwani Ka Sopikwasi, who happened to be an Nkeku, or counselor of the king. Palani, a royal Induna, was monitoring events in the Second Army. Colonel Charles Pearson's number one column included 4,750 men, 384 wagons, and 24 carts. Pearson had not been in action since the Crimean War ended in 1856, spending some time in St. George and Grenada, then various other postings, until he was selected as one of the special service officers in South Africa. Despite his lack of recent combat experience, Pearson had the difficult task of leading the largest column over the greatest distance. He was ordered to cross the lower drift of the Tugela, then establish a base at the evacuated Norwegian mission station of Ishowe, 60 kilometres further on. From there, it's another 113 kilometres to Undini across extremely difficult terrain, most of it mountainous and broken. He led two British infantry battalions, eight companies of his own corps, the 2nd and 3rd Regiment nicknamed the Buffs, plus six companies of the 99th, and these redcoats would be bolstered by 290 sailors of the Naval Brigade based on the HMS Shah and HMS Active. The Sea Dogs were now landlubbers. A company of Royal Engineers joined the regulars, along with a squadron of Imperial Mounted Cavalry, including the Natal Hussars and Victoria Mounted Rifles. Marching in stride with the regulars were two battalions of the Natal Native Contingent, the 1st and 2nd, and the 2nd and 2nd. Supporting all these troops were the road builders and trench diggers of the Natal Native Pioneers. Pearson had two 24-pounder rocket tubes, along with a Gatling machine gun, which had yet to be fired in battle by British troops anywhere in the world. That would soon change in the bushveld of Zululand. A relatively light 7-pounder cannon formed part of this limited artillery, along with a smaller rocket trough. Counting the soldiers, mounted cavalry, engineers, sailors, cooks, cleaners, bottle washers, drivers, and camp followers, the total of men in the column numbered over 5,000. This 8-kilometre-long behemoth crossed the Tugela on the 12th of January, following which Pearson spent 6 days setting up another base camp called Fort Tenedos, watched by Zulu scouts, curiously, from the hills. Summer rainfall was incessant, bogging down the vehicles and slowing their advance. Finally, they began to move further into Zululand on the morning of the 18th of January with a smaller force. Pearson didn't have enough oxen to pull all his 384 wagons, which had rolled through Natal and reached the west bank of the Tugela in relays. Pearson would cross with only 50 wagons, although he did take the best troops in this vanguard. The rest were going to follow a day later. The going was tough, and by the 21st, he'd only managed a paltry 30 kilometres. The rest of his troops were still behind him. The rain had softened the ground, and the territory is also crisscrossed with small streams that flood in summer, making matters worse. If you recall last episode, on the morning of Tuesday 21st of January, Major Dartnell and the NNC in the second column in the centre, 175 kilometres away, were ordered by General Chelmsford to scout southeast of his San Juan. Keep these moving parts in mind because each one has an impact on our story. Back to the coast. Pearson was told by border agent Bernard Finney that a Zulu army led by Godide was on the way, but the intelligence was faulty, saying a smaller number of warriors was heading than actually were. They said a couple of thousand, maybe. We know it was more like 6,000. Since his departure from Kwanodwengu, Godide's army had tripled in size. Later that morning, Zulus spying for the British arrived and informed Pearson that Godide's warriors were actually at hand and had arrived at the royal kraal of Gingindlovu, 10 kilometres away across the coastal flats. Pearson had to make a quick decision. Should he stay or should he go? The bulk of his army was still inching its way toward him. Summing up the situation, he opted to go and sent two companies of the buffs to investigate. Godide, meanwhile, could not see exactly where the British were, and his 6,000 men were lying in wait over the hills to the north. The buffs found nothing, and the British column lagered for the night. Godide's scouts, however, spotted the British camp. That night, 6,000 warriors crept through the darkness, encircling the British camp. A night attack was coming. Godide sat motionless in the silence, his men poised around him. The moment hung in the balance. Should he give the order? Then shouts pierced the night. The Zulu commander tensed. Had they been discovered? The cries rang out again across the darkness. British sentries calling to one another, confirming that each man still lived and watched. Standard practice, routine. But to Godide, these voices meant something else entirely. Their surprise was slipping away. Historians say this moment may well have shaped the entire war. Had Godide struck that night, had Pearson and his men been wiped out, as they likely would have been, the Zulu commander would have found an open road stretching before him to Pietermaritzburg, to Durban. This was the colonists' nightmare scenario, the one that kept Chelmsford awake at night. And considering what was about to unfold with Column 2, the ramifications could have cascaded into something far more catastrophic. Most of Pearson's men were fast asleep, blissfully unaware of the deadly danger. Godide, sure of discovery, ordered his men to pull back quietly across the north bank of the Inyezani River, where the hilly, bush-covered ground was ideal for the Zulu style of war. 6,000 men settled in there for the rest of the night to await the British. The next morning, January 22nd, the British awoke to an ominous sight. A massive swathe of flattened grass stretched near their camp. This wasn't elephants fighting, as the African saying goes. This was what happens when 6,000 men move through tall grass in the dark. The evidence lay before them, waiting to be read. They had been surrounded. A vast army had crept within striking distance during the night. And that army was three times larger than intelligence had reported. Yet Pearson drew neither conclusion. Despite some officers voicing concern, he gave the order to march onward toward Ishowe, straight into a trap. As I've said, there is a remarkable correlation. The two Zulu armies, more than 175 kilometres apart, were going to attack two different British columns at almost exactly the same time on the same day. Bear this in mind, this was long before radio comms and satellite phones. We'll come back to what happened to Pearson's column and the Battle of Inyezani in episode 254, because first we need to swing further north, past Chelmsford and Dartnell and Glynn and Durnford, and to the Ngomi River, where the British left column had been very busy. Colonel Evelyn Wood was tasked with an attack on the Zulu in a wide arc from the Ngomi, Blood River, all the way along the escarpment to the Pongola River. Wood was stationed at Utrecht and had dispatched a garrison of two companies of infantry to Lüneburg, a German mission and farming community further east, closer to the disputed border with the Zulu Kingdom. It was positioned strategically near the Entombi River, a key crossing point for supplies. There, the British established Fort Clary, first to guard the settlers, then to protect the vulnerable line of communication for Colonel Wood's column as it advanced into Zululand. The Amakhulusi lived here, and the action provoked Amakhulusini Regiment to mobilize and march up to the enormous flat-topped Hlobane Mountain. Manyonyoba, the chief, had accepted Cetshwayo's overlordship, his adherents, a mixed group of various chiefdoms shattered by Shaka and then Dingana. They included Zulu, Swazi and Sotho people who had found refuge in the caves of the steep banks of the Ntombi River. Unlike some of the other commanders, Wood was a veteran of multiple conflicts. He'd fought in the Crimea, being a commander during the recent Indian mutiny, where he'd earned a Victoria Cross, and fought in the Ashanti campaign on the Gold Coast of Ghana. The speed at which the British had overcome an African army at the Battle of Amuful in January 1874 arguably contributed to the overconfidence and dismissal of local warnings from people like Major Dunbar that led to the disaster at Isandlwana. Lord Chelmsford, although not involved in the Ashanti campaign for West Africa, was part of this overall climate of confidence that British technology and logistics would easily triumph over any African army. Zulu nicknamed Wood Isukuni, a riff on the Zulu word for wood, and the sobriquet suited the no-frills British soldier, and it was a tribute to his military abilities and tough character. A short man, heavily bewhiskered, with mournful eyes, he was going deaf after a quarter of a century of muskets and rifles and artillery going off in his general vicinity, but he was still tenacious and energetic. Wood's 2,278 men encamped on Bemba's top alongside the Ngomi River when the ultimatum expired on the 11th of January. He'd been joined by an influx of men led by Colonel Rowlands, who'd been based further north of the Transvaal border close to the Pongola River. Wood was able to call on a powerful mobile force. 1,565 of the 2,278 were mounted, and his cavalry was led by Lieutenant Colonel Redvers Buller. While imbued with an uncontrollable temper and being pretty useless at admin and organisation, Buller, at this stage of his life, cut a dramatic figure in South African history, and he fought with zest. He's going to pop up quite a bit in our little tale over the next year or two. Every now and again, someone comes along who appears tailor-made for the job at hand, and Buller was one of those. He was courageous, sometimes to the point of rashness, and a superb horseman. What really set him apart was his natural inclination towards irregular mounted warfare, guerrilla tactics, if you like. Both his enemies and his friends were amazed at Buller's capacity to read the landscape, and in scouting and skirmishing, he seemed to have tactics on a string. Later, however, during the Anglo-Boer War, he would drag the British into terrible conflicts and cause more casualties than necessary, but that's 20 years in the future. Wood convinced Bemba of the Kwanodwengu district to come surrender with 800 cattle, and the Induna was sent to Utrecht, where his cattle and his people would be protected from Zulu revenge attacks. Next to come under Wood's diplomatic spell was Sekhetwayo, who'd been vehemently opposed to the Boer invasions of his territory, but now he was growing old and infirm, and slowly Wood gently reeled him in. When word of the British invasion and the destruction of Sihayo's Kwasokgetle homestead became known, Sekhetwayo began to negotiate surrender and handed over thousands of cattle, sheep and goats, as well as all his horses, to the British. Cetshwayo heard about this, and on the 15th of January, a young impi arrived from Undini and brought Sekhetwayo back into line. From then on, Wood's column was constantly forced to skirmish with groups of Zulu warriors who were well-drilled, and most had firearms. A few days later, on the 20th of January, Sekhetwayo's uncle Tinta surrendered, and he was also relocated to Utrecht, another group in the witness protection program, so to speak. The Amakhulusi continued their dogged fight through the third week of January, joined by clans from the Pongola Valley to the east, who arrived to lend a hand. Wood was well versed in the art of hearts and minds, and unlike Chelmsford and Pearson, he did not embark on the wholesale burning of Zulu homesteads this early in the war. But it was becoming increasingly clear that the Amakhulusi had to be defeated to protect the left flank of the British invasion. So on the 20th of January, Buller led a mounted force of 82 frontier light horse and 23 Transvaal burghers and a picked ace across the White Umfolozi on a reconnaissance mission. Mbilini, who I mentioned a few episodes ago, was a local guerrilla fighter of note. He was one of the Zulu chiefs who'd come from the Pongola and had been in and out of the British bad books for more than a decade, Think of him as Cetshwayo's loose cannon. The recon party headed towards Zungwini Mountain, where Mbilini was based, reinforcing that Kolusi. But the British force ran into Chief Mabomba's men in their Umuzi first, located on the southeastern spur of that mountain. In a short, sharp engagement, the British killed 12 for the loss of one of their men wounded. But they could go no further. More than 1,000 Zulu warriors began taunting Bula's 100 or so mounted men from the summit of Zungwini. More chillingly, Mbilini formed his men into a tight skirmishing conventional formation of three columns, the two wings and a chest, and launched a blitz attack on Bula. He was forced to conduct a fighting retreat all the way back to the Watumfuluzi, where the cavalry dismounted and drove the Zulu back with a series of accurate volleys. This all had been quite a shock for Bula and the British for a number of reasons. One of the reasons was most of the Amakulusi warriors were armed with an array of muskets and rifles. These had been imported via Delagoa Bay, courtesy of Cetshwayo's gunrunner, John Dunn. The second reason to be fearful, the Zulu had attacked with regular orders, highly disciplined, sure of their skirmishing tactics, attuned to the broken terrain, and supreme knowledge of the territory. And in silence, just the sound of their shields being rattled, which rattled Bula's party. Colonel Isikuni Wood was in a quandary. Like his brethren further south, he too was considering a major action on the 22nd of January, 1879. He had to defeat the Amakulusi once and for all. That meant, for our story, the setup on three fronts in Zululand is the same, separated by hundreds of kilometers, all focused on this one day in history. But wait, one more thing. Back in the center of the British invasion, the main Zulu army had shifted from Sepezi Mountain to the Ingwebeni Valley, which lies northeast of Isandlwana. The original plan was to advance up the Mangeni Valley to the Imzinyati River on the south, then outflank the British and fall on them from behind, precisely what Chelmsford was fretting about. That was going to cut him off from his Rorke's Drift base. The obvious choice to lead in Chingwayo Kamahori Khoza's warriors over the broken ground along the Mangeni Valley was local chief Machana Kamundisa of the Sitoli. And you've heard about his previous life in Natal. Later, Mpandi had settled him in the Kuleni Badlands southeast of Isandlwana. Most of the Zulu commanders distrusted Machana Kamundisa because he'd recently told Msinga resident magistrate Henry Francis Finn Jr. he wanted to defect to the British side. The Zulu commanders switched plans, but used Machana as a decoy. They were killing two birds with one stone. They were going to trick Chelmsford by deploying Machana along the Mangeni Valley and removing the somewhat fickle chief from direct involvement in the main event. Adding to this dramatic moment, Chelmsford was going to commit an elementary military error by dividing and then widely separating his force still further. Ah, yes, you say, but the Zulu were doing the same. Well, not exactly. In the infinitely interesting rules of war, courtesy of Clausewitz or Sun Tzu, the army that has initiative and surprise and uses deception of this sort, i.e. splitting up, compels the enemy to move according to their plan. And initiative and surprise is everything. Thus, on the morning of the 21st, Major John Dartnell's 150 mounted police and Commandant Lonsdale's 1,600 Natal native contingent troops were led on a wild goose chase by Machana's impi. Despite the chief's earlier misgivings, Machana's men did their job magnificently, easily retiring before the mounted police and the NNC. Their white NCOs began to wilt in the 33 degrees Celsius blazing sun. So too the officers, and they were riding horses, for goodness sake. 2,000 Zulu amassed on the Magogo Heights to the east. This was now 20 kilometers from Isandlwana. Once again, the NNC and Dartnell's small party pursued them, growing more exhausted. The mounted police tried to outflank the Zulu, but that backfired. The tables were turned with precision. The warriors broke into two fast-moving horns and ran in skirmishing order towards the riders. The British were alarmed and withdrew before being overrun. The Zulu attack halted. The sun began to set. Dartnell formed his men into a hollow square formation on the Hlazakazi Heights nearby. He believed that he'd now be able to stop the main Zulu force from advancing on Isandlwana. That night, the Zulu lit fires around their position and kept these going all night. And during the night, there were also numerous false alarms. The NNC panicked, and they opened fire at one point, little realizing that everything was smoke and mirrors. Dartnell then panicked, believing his men were on the edge of collapse, and sent a message to Chelmsford pleading for reinforcements. Later, before dawn, a dense mist rose out of the Mungeni Valley, settling over the hills and Dartnell's men like a cold, wet blanket, causing more fear and loathing. Meanwhile, and miraculously, the messenger had managed to evade the Zulu warriors and completed the terrifying 20-kilometer journey, arriving in Isandlwana at 1:30 in the morning. Lord Chelmsford was awoken, and hearing of Dartnell's apparent predicament, made the fatal decision to personally lead a large force out of Isandlwana camp at 4 a.m. on the morning of the 22nd of January to save his men. This was the decision I mentioned earlier, weakening the units at Isandlwana still further as he marched out of the tented camp with six companies of the 2nd and 24th Regiment, as well as all six 7-pounder guns. 1,300 men marched off, leaving about 1,500 behind. And still, they had not entrenched, nor put up stone sangars or low walls, nor had they lagered any of the wagons. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms that helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm eventually going to load updates about various of these episodes. You can also email me from there and sign up for my newsletter. Until next, goodbye.